Welcome to the My Money podcast, where we discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. Now, whenever I'm trying to wrap my head around a complex financial trend, I do what any good journalist does and I ask the experts. And right now, the space I'm watching the most closely is the evolution of stablecoins. So, unlike highly volatile cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, which everyone's familiar with, stablecoins are digital assets which are pegged to a stable currency. So, for example, the US dollar or the South African rand. But because their value doesn't wildly fluctuate, isn't going up and down every single day, they have a huge potential as a mainstream payment mechanism for everyday consumers like you and I. And this is especially true for cross-border transactions, where they can make payments faster and so much cheaper. So for all of us, understanding how they work is going to become essential. The challenge, however, is that our regulators and courts are fundamentally divided on how to treat these digital assets, especially when it comes to exchange control. And we've just seen a major twist in the saga because a high court judgment has ruled that moving crypto assets to an offshore wallet counts as exporting capital without permission. And this completely clashes with a ruling from last year that said the exact opposite. So we are officially in uncharted legal territory. And the implications for stablecoins and the future of cross-border digital payments are massive. So today we're going to look past the hype. We're going to unpack exactly how this ruling changes the game and give you a masterclass in how stablecoins fit into your financial future. Joining me to make sense of it all is Vian Olafier, partner and global co-head of digital assets at Forest Mazars. So welcome. Thank you. And I'm so, so looking forward to this conversation ever since you wrote your opinion piece last week. So welcome. And before we get on to stablecoins and explaining what it is, you wrote a really, really great opinion piece on the court ruling. I think it was on the 1st of June or so. And please explain to us what this means, because until then, until that court ruling, you could actually externalize your money and bypass exchange controls.
So definitely an interesting space to be in, especially given the contradicting views that we currently see in the market. But I think what's fundamentally important that we take a couple of steps back and just firstly understand exchange control regulations and where we find ourselves in terms of the Standard Bank versus South African Reserve Bank court case. And then fast forward to the ruling that came out last week, Monday. So first of all, an individual within the borders of South Africa are not freely allowed to externalize funds. So effectively what that means is you can't go and sell your rand to buy X amount of US dollars. You can only do that within the ambit of what exchange control regulations effectively allows. You know, the exchange control regulations have been around since 1961, and most countries have abolished their exchange control regulation over the last couple of years. However, South Africa is still one of the few countries that has these exchange control regulations still in place. However, I don't want to go too much in the philosophical side of it or the debate whether we need exchange control regulations, but rather just focus on the facts. So with the exchange control regulation, individual could only externalize 2 million rand. It used to be 1 million rand. It was changed with a budget speech earlier this year to 2 million rand, but 2 million rand single discretionary allowance. That's effectively when you go on overseas holidays or you want to make investments here or there in abroad. Therefore, you would use your single discretionary allowance, and that you can do without needing approval from anyone in terms of utilizing that. Now, the second element to that is the foreign investment allowance. So each individual within the South African borders of South Africa or natural persons in South Africa are allowed to externalize up until an additional amount of 10 million being your foreign investment allowance. Now you can, as a natural person in South Africa, externalize up to 12 million South African rand on a calendar year basis. That is effectively the constraint in terms of what we see within the South African context.
So, I think for what a lot of people are saying to me is they're saying, well, I don't even have a million to go take. So for most South Africans, it does this really matter, exchange control? So, you know, most of us, 12 million seems like a fair amount every year that we could take out. We'd be very happy to have 12 million to take out.
So what's interesting in the crypto space, a lot of people have been doing this since earlier years. So the Bitcoin price, for example, was higher in South Africa compared to other countries. So what they would do, they would use these single discretionary allowance and foreign investment allowance. They would take their rand, let's say 500,000 rand on a stage. They would externalize that with the single discretionary foreign investment allowance, buy Bitcoin abroad, send Bitcoin back to South Africa using blockchain technology, and liquidate it here. Now, that premium, that arbitrage premium, was sitting between 20% back in 2015, 2016, all the way now to where we are today. It's basically decreased to, I think, 0.3% currently, the arbitrage is trading. So there was a lot of money to be made from a cryptocurrency arbitrage perspective back then. That's why a lot of people within the digital asset space understand and utilize those exchange control limits every single year. But I think where it became really interesting is the South African Reserve Bank said that cryptocurrency is not money, so it doesn't fall within the ambit of exchange control regulations, or rather, it's not overseen by them. And that was a stance that they always took up until, I believe it was early 2025 or late 2024, where there was a specific court ruling, or not could really, a court case between the South African Reserve Bank and Standard Bank of South Africa regarding an individual whose account was basically liquidated, if I remember correctly. Now, in that court case, what happened is the South African Reserve Bank had made an argument that the externalization of Bitcoin we deemed to be capital or a right in capital. That was the argument set forward by the South African Reserve Bank. Now, at the start of last year, that ruling came to a closing, and it found that the court ruled in favor of Standard Bank. And effectively, the judge said at that point in stage that the African Reserve Bank had completely and utterly failed in trying to regulate cryptocurrency as a currency for the purposes of exchange control regulations. Of course, subsequent to that, the court case was up for appeal because the South African Reserve Bank had appealed that. So at that point in stage, we almost got an idea in terms of where we would land. Now, there's this strong case that the externalization of crypto would not be externalization of capital. Now, what does that mean? So if I go onto a crypto exchange in South Africa and I purchase South African, or I have my South African rand deposited into the exchange and I purchase Bitcoin, no externalization event takes place. But now when I send that Bitcoin to a foreign exchange, then potentially we look at the externalization because it moves across the borders. Now, in this instance, with the court case and the finding from the third court case, they ruled that it is not capital. So that externalization from Bitcoin from a local exchange to a foreign exchange does not constitute an externalization event. But individuals need to be careful when they consider that, because it doesn't mean when you swap from Bitcoin to Ether, still not a currency, so still not externalization. But when you swap from Ether or Bitcoin to a US dollar, that triggers the externalization event, because now you're effectively buying foreign currency with your South African rand. So, and that was the thing that people had to take a look for, because a lot of people were participating in things that we refer to as bot trading. It is algorithms that trains on a constant basis based on specific market scenarios, but then a lot of externalization events could potentially be triggered without the required approval. So that's where we found ourselves. So we almost had clarity, and it was like a watershed moment within the digital asset sector, saying that, okay, cryptocurrency, including Bitcoin, including US dollar-backed stablecoins, were not deemed to be capital for the purpose of exchange control regulations. However, that was up for appeal. Therefore, they couldn't make a definitive ruling on this is the case, this is what it's going to be like forward. And that was always the idea in terms of exchange control regulations, where we would land. Fast forward to earlier this year, and I believe it is even a month or two ago, we had the new capital flow management regulations coming that specifically deals with exchange control regulation. And in that, they scoped again cryptocurrency into new exchange control regulations. So it goes against the Standard Bank versus South African Reserve Bank ruling that's up for appeal, and said, well, cryptocurrency should be classified as capital or right to capital in terms of exchange control regulations. But there's a lot of other, if I can call it, tails added on to that specific regulation that I don't want to go into too much detail. But effectively, it always there was the anticipation that we're moving towards a direction where crypto would fall in the ambit of exchange control regulations. Because if you look at the statistics and the analytics, the amount of a US dollar-backed stablecoin and Bitcoin actually moving from South African sources to foreign sources It's more moving out as moving in. So you can see there is a leakage or outflow of South African rand through cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, Ether, stablecoins, and the like, to an extent that it surpasses whatever is flowing into South Africa. So you can see fundamentally, potentially, people are using Bitcoin and cryptocurrency to circumvent exchange control regulations. All right. So once the draft proposal for the new regulations came out, people were quite up in arms in terms of specific wording what was used, but it is very important that it was a draft proposal that was being issued. And of course, I think the deadline was, if I'm not mistaken, it was mid of last month, and that had been extended to the end of this month. Now we backtrack to last week, Monday, another court ruling came out. And this was interesting. This was specifically in relation to an individual that externalized, I believe, 1,680 Bitcoin. I think the equal value, I can't remember if it's 1.3 billion, but a significant amount was effectively externalized.
Significantly more than exchange control. I mean, they wouldn't be able to take that money out of the country any other way.
Correct.
Do we know if that person's money was made by Bitcoin? So in other words, they bought Bitcoin 10 years ago and it's been the growth in the Bitcoin, or did they actually purchase those Bitcoin to externalize money? You know, there's two different, one could have just simply made a lot of money out of Bitcoin in that period.
Correct. So what happened here, and this does raise a lot of questions beside from exchange control regulation. So a lot of the time, individuals would interact on a peer-to-peer marketplace. So they would engage with someone that wants to purchase Bitcoin. And you as an individual say, well, I'm going to source Bitcoin for you on platform X, Y, and Z up until the point of, let's say, for example, I've accumulated 10 Bitcoin. And then he or she said they're willing to pay this price for the Bitcoin. So you go source it as cheap as possible to get together the 10 Bitcoin. You say to that individual, I've got the 10 Bitcoin. Then they ask, where do you want to send it? You say you want to send it, or they tell you they want to send it there. You execute that transaction and you get paid in South African rand. Now, this individual did it over a period of a couple of years, effectively doing that on a regular basis and taking its profit on that little bit of a spread based on what he's able to buy Bitcoin and what the other person is able to pay. And he kept on sending the Bitcoin in a one-way direction. And of course, when this African Reserve Bank looked at it, they said that he externalized effectively 1,680 Bitcoin over a period of a number of years. And they did analytical tools finding that the receiving address was tied to a foreign cryptocurrency exchange. Therefore, they were of the opinion that he externalized cryptocurrency. Now, externalized capital or a right to capital? That was the argument. Now, in the new court case ruling, interestingly enough, the judge was aware and was knowing of the previous ruling based on the South African Reserve Bank versus Standard Bank. And in his ruling, he explicitly said that he understands that that's what the circumstances and the facts of that court case. However, he's not in agreement with those circumstances. In fact, he looked at it more from a practical standpoint, which I can appreciate as well. He said that Bitcoin is being utilized to facilitate the transaction to bypass exchange control regulations that would be applicable to the South African rand. So it was his view that effectively this would need to fall within the ambit of exchange control regulations.
Because I know when I read the judgment, he was saying we shouldn't be looking at the mechanisms. We should be looking at the intention, I suppose. And that's exactly it. I mean, that falls into a typical SARS thing. You know, was the purpose of this to evade paying tax? And in this case, it was to evade exchange control. So would that be his argument?
Correct. So you look at the substance over form type of scenario in terms of what is actually happening here. Mm-hmm. And he broke it down into the nature of the transaction as opposed to the technological focus of it in its entirety. So that's the approach that he effectively took. Now, I know there's a lot of people that would argue against it because it goes against a different ruling. He said that cryptocurrency is both capital and money, but then you have the National Payment Services Act that says cryptocurrency is not capital and money. So there's a lot of legal clashes in terms of the definition of where we land with cryptocurrency. That's why a lot of work still needs to be done in terms of defining and including the asset clause within multiple regulations. And I think to that part as well, we've been extremely slow in incorporating these relevant laws and regulations. I mean, if you look at something like a tax act, The only differences, the only changes rather, to the Tax Act when this new asset class was introduced is they defined the word crypto asset in cryptocurrency, and they stated that the normal rules apply without any authoritative guidance as well. So I think that is the big concern, is there isn't a lot of clarity. And even now with exchange control regulations, we have that lack of clarity because now you've got two court rulings saying different things. You've got the draft legislation that is out. Now, a lot of people are asking, what is the point of the draft legislation if the court ruling was that crypto is capital or right to capital? So there's a lot of uncertainty in the market. And one of the fundamental questions is we have, besides from the fact is on which do we rely now, we ask the question is this retrospectively applicable? Because the facts and the circumstances based on the nature of crypto has always been the same. So the question, has these facts and circumstances always existed?
I mean, it's quite an interesting one. How can he have broken the law if it was a court case, previous court case, that said he hadn't? So you're saying, well, yeah, at the time, given the information that I understood, I acted within the law. So it's a very interesting, it's going to be a very interesting argument. But I think also in South Africa, what we see, and I see this with the Kofi bill, with so many of the things, is that our legislation takes forever. It is not a quick process. And in the meantime, the courts tend to often make, you know, set precedent. So it is going to be interesting. I mean, do you think that this court case will, to some degree, guide the draft legislation as well?
We can concede the direction where the draft legislation is going. And in my view, if I think from a governance perspective, let's take out of the equation that whether exchange control regulations are needed or not. But if I were in Treasury's position, then yes, based on the draft legislation, then that is the direction we basically move in. That is the anticipated in terms of what is required. But if you think about it, and let's say for argument's sake, exchange control regulations needs to be there, and these are the set parameters that we need to operate in, then I fully agree, because any individual in South Africa, based on how the controls are set up and how the monitoring is set up, can externalize funds in excess of their 12 million rand on a year. So yes, I do understand that why this legislation is needed and why we're moving in the direction of the draft proposal.
So I think you've done a great summary of what's happened with this court case. And again, we're not answering, we can't really answer anybody's questions. I'm going to be tons of questions saying, well, is it or isn't it? Well, I think the answer is we don't actually know at this stage, but you may want to err on the side of caution. And I've had quite a lot of people coming to me saying, well, with stable coins, you know, does this mean it's outside of exchange control? And I think the important thing is it's when you exit, as you said, you know, when you convert that stable coin into something, then you are now back into exchange control. So it is an interesting space. But I wanted to, as I mentioned in my intro, I wanted to look at stable coins in specifically. I think everyone knows what Bitcoin are, and I actually don't know if anyone really understands how it works, but they know it goes up sometimes and they can make money. But from a really practical perspective, and this is where I want to ask your opinion, the way I'm seeing stablecoins evolving is that within 2 years' time, people are going to be using them widely. So for me, there's a lot of education that needs to happen around this. I mean, they're becoming the sort of the new software layer, I suppose, for global banking. And, you know, the implications for me, if I think about it, when I get paid an invoice internationally and I have it deposited in my bank and I lose 1,000 rand in fees and it takes a week and I don't actually know if the money's there or not, what are the applications of stable coins? Where do you see it going?
Yeah, so I think it's quite interesting and also to understand exactly where stable coins come from, because Bitcoin's white paper was released back in 2008 and the first transaction executed in 2009. And the idea behind Bitcoin was to facilitate peer-to-peer payments over the internet without the need for an intermediary. Now, it used that by combining already existing technologies. And a lot of people would argue then that something like Bitcoin is money. But to be money, it needs to be a unit of account. It needs to be a medium of exchange, and it needs to be a store value. Now, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency, store value, yes, you can see that. Medium of exchange, yes, you can actually pay for goods and services in Bitcoin. You can go down to Pick n Pay and pay for your groceries in Bitcoin. But unit of account, where it fell short in terms of being defined as money, because it was extremely volatile. Now, fast forward to where we were with Bitcoin, and to where we saw the creation of smart contract-enabled blockchains like Ethereum. They were allowed for us to create non-native tokens on the Ethereum blockchain. So Ethereum, the blockchain, Ether, the currency. Bitcoin, the blockchain, capital B, lowercase Bitcoin, the currency. Now Ethereum blockchain, non-native token. So you can go and you can create Maya tokens on the blockchain, for example, at a whim, and you can set the parameters in terms of the token issuance and all of that. Now, what stablecoin issuers did is they said for every dollar that they received into their bank account, they would issue one US dollar digital representation on the blockchain. So now you've got an asset, a cryptocurrency sitting on the blockchain that's backed by a real world asset, and it can move over the internet as freely as information moves over the internet. So it's got all the functionalities of traditional cryptocurrencies. And that is where we started to see utility and the utilization of cryptos. Give you, I always use this example. You said about being paid an invoice from abroad. So back in 2015, 2016, when I worked abroad, I wanted to send funds back to South Africa. And when I did that, I used normal banking wires. So I sent that transaction. It took about 5 days to execute the transaction, and it cost, I think, about 1,600 rand to execute that transaction. Now, if we look at the end of 2022, where Forbes Mazars had done some work for a country or a specific company in the Asian Pacific region, and I said, pay me in stable coins as opposed to the banking railways, because then it would be a mission to get the money into our South African bank account. I could rather develop a system whereby I took a receipt of stable coins. So we white label the address quickly, just on chain, making sure that everything is above board and nothing's been intercepted. But effectively what happened is I asked them to execute the transaction. It took 3 minutes. The funds were sitting in my on-chain wallet. And then I liquidated that onto an OTC desk immediately and then cashed that out in the bank account. So that the whole transaction between 2 o'clock and 5 o'clock, at 5 o'clock, the cash was in my bank account. So you can see, even from an efficiency point of view and from a cash flow point of view, that made sense. So from a practical standpoint, where can we use stable coins in our day-to-day lives? Even though a large volume of stable coins are being utilized with those bot tradings we previously spoke about, we do see real-world use cases of that. So when I do pay for external good or service, I can actually pay it with a stable coin as opposed to utilizing my bank account. Where we see, I think, two fundamental cases within South Africa and within Africa is a hedge against the devaluation of local fiat currencies, and I'll come back to that, and cross-border payments and remittances. So what we see in Africa, we see a lot of currency devaluating. I was on an airplane yesterday with a colleague from Egypt, for example, and he said how the Egyptian currency had devalued in a period over 10 years, and it was actually quite ridiculous compared to the US dollar. Now, what a lot of people in Africa are doing is when they receive their remuneration or their salary or whatever the case may be, they buy US dollar backed stable coins. And then they slowly use that on a day-to-day basis. Then, of course, they hedge themselves as opposed to getting their currency at the start of the month. And by the end of the month, the currency from their local federal bank or federal reserve has deteriorated in value. They rather use stable coins as a hedge. Another example would be, for example, when people execute cross-border payments and remittances. And I always use this example. My gardener, for example, he is from Malawi. So he comes, he works in my gardener, and I pay him and he needs to send money back home. Now, currently, money remittance and transfer companies usually charge anything between 7 to 10% on that transaction to remit that funds back to his family. Now, these money remittance companies have started to integrate stable coins into their business model, effectively decreasing that 7 to 10% to as low as 2 to 5%. So that is in terms of removing the friction posed by the traditional banking system. And I think that's very important, is putting the funds back into the hands of individuals. That individual that is working in South Africa could execute that same transaction with stable coins, bearing in mind there might be some on and off ramping fee, but he can do it himself for a fee as low as 2%. So that is examples of how that effectively puts hands back into to the individual. But of course, there's also the inflow. A lot of people want to get paid in stablecoin. So there's a lot of South Africans actually working for companies abroad that now take receipt of US dollar backed stablecoins. And there's a huge market in South Africa on the buy and sell side. So they don't have any issues in terms of liquidity. Stablecoins effectively translate to the same rate as the US dollar. And of course, your cash is always immediate when you deal with these on and off ramps as well. So there's utility there.
Just the off ramp. So when you now, so now I get, so would I use, for example, a Luno platform? I'd say pay me in my Luno account. And from there, I would then convert it into to rands. Forex is one of the biggest money spinners for banks, but by a long way. And you know how I know this is that they give me more reward points for Forex transactions. So we know they're making a lot of money out of Forex. Do you think this is going to completely and utterly end their model? Or do you think they're going to put pressure on the Reserve Bank to say, you know, contain this? We need to have more oversight or something. I mean, what do you think the outcome is going to be for banks?
For the banks themselves, they've been operating in a regulated space in terms of exchange control regulation. So they wouldn't mind the status quo, that everything just continues as it always been continuing. The big question is whether banks will start to adapt. And we've seen that abroad and we've seen that locally as well. Banks are actively looking to incorporate stable coins and cryptocurrency into their business models. I think the Nedbank announced, I believe it was earlier this year, that you can actually now hold cryptocurrency and buy cryptocurrency within their environment. You've got APSA as well. They're looking to use Ripple for stable coins, cross-border payments and remittances as well. You've got larger banks with the venture capital arms investing in these types of initiatives. You've got larger banks also looking to make acquisitions of cryptocurrency exchanges. So slowly but surely, you see the banks looking at cryptocurrency and virtual asset service providers and the asset class more diligently, because they see the utility in terms of the, I think about the challenges in terms of what exchanges are currently doing versus their banking model. And of course, they want to get a cut of the pie. So it's the next logical step, basically, for banks to start to incorporate stable coins in their banking business model. Because how easy would it be if I said to someone, they need to pay me in stable coins, I gave them my smart contract address that flows through to my banking Omnibus wallet and I get the rand into my account effective immediately. I think those are the type of initiatives that banks are looking to incorporate in the longer run.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's all incredibly exciting. And I mean, I see if you look at the money that Visa, MasterCard, Stripe are spending on the infrastructure, I mean, it's billions that they are. So they are very much part of that. So I think we will get to a point where you'll probably be able to use your Visa card, tap used, you know, selected from your stablecoin wallet, pay. So, I mean, I think there's such a payments revolution coming. And I suppose my worry, you know, the people who are, you know, arbitrage trading and doing all of these things already understand this market. But the average person, when I need to explain to my mother what a stablecoin is, you know, she just was like, I don't know if I want to know. This is too confusing. So how do you think that's going to be a big challenge? The next step is going to be explaining to people how this payment system works. Or do you think we're just going to kind of almost put a friendly user interface on it, so you don't actually know what rail is being used?
So I 100% agree with the fact that it's going to become part of the financial plumbing without us even knowing it or even understanding it. If you think about where people went from going to the bank and dealing with a cashier to where we now everything is online. I mean, even that transition was a significant step for us in the banking environment. And I mean, the step towards cryptocurrency or stablecoins incorporated into that is also going to be a major step, but it will become part of the norm at the end of the day. Because if you think about the direction that we are moving in. And if you think about the traditional financial services sector, and we specifically look at the banking business model that we spoke about that will incorporate cryptocurrency and stablecoins, are already doing it. If you think about property, the tokenization of property, where you effectively go and you take that property and you create that digital representation on a blockchain that can be divided as well and can move on a blockchain. It's immutable. You keep record of it. It's auditable. So all those characteristics play a role. If you look at asset management, you've got the tokenization of funds, you've got funds investing in crypto and underlying assets, you've got the payment sector. Everywhere, cryptocurrency and stable coins are going to play a significant role, and it will be part of the plumbing to such an extent that we don't even know it's there. I mean, you have earlier this year, the S&P 500 exchange in the United States actually applied to the Security Exchange Commission to have a dual system of their traditional stocks, and they want to put the portion of their stocks on the blockchain. So now you can go in within a decentralized finance environment, you can go buy stock of a US-based company with your US dollar-backed stable coins, and you can keep it on a wallet somewhere or self-custody it or whatever the case may be. And that's all very important. Everything's going to start to interflow, intermesh between each other. And I think that's important for us to understand. And stable coins will become that fiber that pulls everything together and adds real value in terms of cross-border flow and payment. And of course, also sets the stage for agentic finance, which we are expected to make a significant impact in the future.
I think that's important. We don't need to, I think, you know, from me as a financial educator, somebody who's trying to explain to people how things work, I think one has to be careful as to how technical you get. Because at the end of the day, you're going to engage with it the way you always have. It's just, what is the tech behind it that's lowering the costs and making it faster, the transactions faster? And, you know, I mean, we're going to see more and more. I was speaking to an asset manager who they're going to be tokenizing one of their international credit private corporate credit funds. You know, that's just going to make it so much more accessible to South Africans. They can put it on the Luno platform. You can buy that. It's kind of, but it's also, I just think it's going to be such a disruptor as well as to what the platforms are. Right now you have a Lisp and you have, you know, you've got your traditional asset manager platform. Soon you're going to actually be able to use your crypto platform, like a Luno. I keep using them because they're a well-known brand in South Africa, but you can probably use that to actually hold all your assets. So I think those are some of the technological changes and disruptions that are really going to come up.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, it's going to be everywhere. I mean, you don't necessarily have to fully understand and appreciate the technology, just trusting the partner that you're working with, either from a tokenization perspective or, very important, from a custody perspective, that you trust the individual that you're partnering with. And I think that's a big role we play in the industry currently, because you've got the world of blockchain and digital assets on the one side, and you've got TradFi, traditional finance, on the other side. Now, what Forbes Bazaars is basically trying to do is close that bridge, because we've been working in the traditional financial services sector forever. And now we've got the expertise and experience in digital assets, basically pulling those two together and say, well, this is what we need to do, and this is how we build trust in the sector. And that's where the value really comes in. It's building the trust, giving the likes of your mother comfort that she would be able to execute a transaction with stablecoin and do it in a seamless manner, putting money back into her hands, and of course do it in a safe manner. What is very important, and that effectively is the fundamental rule of why we have legislation in South Africa. It is to protect stakeholders. Yeah.
And I think that's the frustration of this, is that if the regulations and legislation doesn't keep up, you're removing protection, because it's happening. It's happening. So if your legislation is not keeping up with it, you're opening up, you know, potential people to potential fraud and bad actors. So yeah, absolutely, incredibly important space. And if only our legislators worked as fast as the blockchain does. I mean, I'm waiting for the entire of South Africa's property market to be put onto a blockchain, so you don't have to go and spend 40, 50, 60,000 rand for the conveyance and wait 3 months for your title deed. So wouldn't that be nice?
I mean, that's a topic that's been as old as I've been in the blockchain industry, from, was that 2017, where people are talking tokenization of property and getting rid of the deeds office is the first step in terms of what blockchain technology will actually solve for the man on the street.
Absolutely. Well, I'm really enjoyed chatting to you. I'm definitely going to be keeping up with you, because I think this we can't probably talk enough about it in terms of education, but I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Maya, thanks so much for the time. I really appreciate it.